You're with us for another great hour of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You can recite the mantra in your sleep by now: spend less, have more. But practically speaking, just how do you accomplish that on a daily basis? Two words, Kevin McKinley. He's a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, joining us this morning from WPR's friendly studio there in Eau Claire. Hiya, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And your pressing personal finance questions, your stories, your situations, they're in the mix as we learn from them at 800-642-1234. Send your money question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Kevin, here's the deal. Most of us need to spend less and save more. There are a lot of studies out there, surveys out there that show us how we can accomplish those goals. So what gives?
Well, Kate, you know, we can throw numbers and charts and worry some statistics and data at people all we want. But the fact is that most of our emotional decisions about spending are really dictated by what goes on in our gut rather than our brain. And it's difficult with being human beings to always make the rational decision that we sometimes know we need to do but aren't able to do it. And in fact, as you've mentioned, I have offices in Madison and Eau Claire, and in the conference room, both of the conference rooms do not have, they don't have a large table in the middle. Instead, we have a long leather couch, and we have tissues on either side of the sofa and everything like that. And a lot of people, the first time they walk into the conference room, they say, this feels like a therapist's office. And and that's an acknowledgement that, you know, I've done this for 30 years, and I do understand that all the charts and graphs that we have that demonstrate different principles and steps we should take really aren't helpful unless the people emotionally buy in to some of the things that they need to do. And so we have several examples of the way people can use their emotional foibles and psychological drawbacks to improve their financial situation.
So if you had to pick one area of behavioral finance, where should we start?
It would be delaying gratification. A couple of PhD candidates from Kansas State University, which actually has a very strong personal finance program, Philip Zepp and Stuart Heckman, did a study where they found that the people who were more likely to delay gratification financially and save money for the longer term were ones who had an attitude of, rather than living for today, that they lived for tomorrow. And the key components that they found of those people who were likely to save were to be optimistic and to be positive, to envision your future self, what you think you will look like in retirement or when you're 50 or 55 and your kids are going to college, rather than having that person be viewed as a separate entity that isn't you. That's the person you are going to be. And then Bankrate actually had a very good survey where they said the number one regret that older Americans had about what they wish they would have done earlier in life is they wish they would have saved more money for retirement and started sooner saving. And I can say that's definitely true from the experience I have of talking with literally thousands of people about their personal finance situation.
So with that 2020 hindsight, how might we improve our savings rate?
Yeah, other than going back in time, one way that people, whether you're 20 years old or 50 years old or 60 years old, is to make it automatic. We found there's been a rule in place where many 401k and 403b plans have implemented an auto-enrollment feature where as soon as an employee signs on and is eligible to save for retirement, that person has to opt out. Otherwise, a certain dollar amount will be pulled out of their paycheck and put into that person's retirement plan at work every single paycheck. And there are even some plans out there that have an automatic escalator, meaning that if you start out saving 4% in the first year automatically, you save 5% the next year, et cetera. And people have found that they are more likely to save more. And one of the analogies I use is said, let's say you're making, you know, $50,000 a year. And all of a sudden you say, I can't save any money. I can't afford to save any money. But all of a sudden your boss came and said, I'm really sorry. Times are tough. We're going to have to cut back. We're cutting you back 10% on your salary. Now you're making $45,000 a year. Well, chances are you might start looking for another job, but more likely you'd figure out ways to cut back so you can still live off the $45,000 a year rather than the $50,000 a year. Well, try to do the same thing by setting aside 10% of your salary. Do it and then figure out if you can survive on that. You can always change it back. And the same thing goes for Roth IRAs. You can actually have money directed from your checking account every single month into a Roth IRA that you can start and stop and raise and lower whenever you feel like it, if you do get really tight. But it's a good way to have money going into some kind of rainy day account and not have to think about actually making the deposit.
And what about the spending we do?
Yeah, the same way. In the same way that you want to make saving as thoughtless and painless as possible, spending is the opposite. You want to make it as painful as you possibly can. There are several studies we've seen that if you walk into a store with just cash and no plastic, you are more likely to spend less money than if you know that you have a debit and credit card that you can draw from to cover the cost of the purchase. And it's the same thing with your money that you spend each week. We found that people who take cash with them wherever they go and don't use plastic, keep their spending to a limit, like putting yourself on an allowance. Say you figure out that during the week you know that you have $100 of typical expenses that you have during the week. Well, on Sunday night, you go to the ATM, you get five $20 bills, and you put those in your pocket, and that's all you have to spend for the week, and you have to make that money last for at least the week and use the plastic just for emergencies. Also, give yourself a cooling off period. If you find something online or in the store that you really want to buy and you kind of know you shouldn't, tell yourself, you know what, I'm going to think about this for 48 hours. And most of the time, the impulse to spend that money will pass within the 48 hours, and you'll forget that you ever wanted this thing or so-called needed this thing. And finally, a couple of different studies that we've seen, and I know this from personal experience as well. When you want to do something that you know you shouldn't do, like you want to buy something or you want to have that extra donut this morning or whatever it is, the actual gratification you get from not doing it is greater than the gratification you get from doing it. It's a higher level of pleasure sensor in the brain. It lasts longer, and you get much better enjoyment out of saying, hey, I was tempted by this thing and I didn't do it. I'm proud of myself for having that discipline. And that is more gratifying than actually wolfing down that eclair or bear claw or whatever you've had your eyes on. So try to say, hey, I know by not doing this, I'm going to get more enjoyment than if I actually do it.
Caloric edition of On Your Money. I'm hearing it now. Kevin McKinley is managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And now for your personal finance questions that are on your mind, ask away at 800-642-1234. You can draft an email, send it our way to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Dave joining us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Dave.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well.
Well, this is a big thank you to Kevin because I followed his advice and filed for my Social Security when I turned 62 in March. And unbeknownst to me, I have a son that's 16, and he will also be able to collect Social Security at the same time, and it'll probably be more than enough to pay for at least 1 year of college.
Oh, fantastic, Dave. Now, wait just a second. When you say unbeknownst, was the feature unbeknownst that your son could actually qualify for Social Security benefits, or was the son unbeknownst to you?
No, unbeknownst that he'd be able to collect the Social Security.
Ah, okay, good. Either way, it's fine. I just wanted to clarify and make sure that I understood the situation. Yes, and we're going to talk about this a little later on. The longer that Americans wait to have children, the more likely it is that they will reach Social Security age and have a minor child whom that once you initiate your benefits, as you did, Dave, you can have extra money for that beneficiary under the age of 18 as well. So it's not an exploitation or any type of malfeasance on your part. It's the rule, and you're just taking advantage of the rule. So good for you. It's not a long-lasting one, especially from 16 to 18, but any extra bit helps once the kids go off to college.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for calling in. And a listener named Nancy says, my father was recently diagnosed with dementia, and my mom will need additional money available beyond her monthly budget to pay out-of-pocket health care expenses to satisfy a 90-day elimination period before long-term care coverage becomes effective. He has more than one IRA in his name and multiple life insurance policies that are paid in full. So without knowing my parents' portfolio, what is the best approach or account location to draw money with the least penalty to pay the immediate expenses for health care?
Yeah, this is a very tough situation that more and more people are facing where, just due to the natural aging process, find themselves with a parent or a spouse, partner, who is declining in health, mentally or physically, and you're really thrust into the caregiver role because there's nobody else who can do it. So this one, financially anyway, sounds better than most. With the long-term care insurance in place, assets in form of the IRA, first of all, if Nancy's father is over 70 and a half, obviously he's going to have to take the required minimum distribution during this year anyway, so she might as well take that now and use the money to help pay for that 90-day elimination period. That, by the way, for people who aren't familiar with it, when you have a long-term care insurance policy, usually there's an elimination period that says the family has to pay for the first 90 days of care before the insurance kicks in. Hmm. It's usually not a lot of money, but it can be significant for it. It's kind of like the deductible for a car insurance or a health insurance policy. So take the money from the IRA now for the required minimum distribution. And that and other withdrawals from the IRA will be taxable as ordinary income, but they may be deductible because the portion of this nursing home care that is medical may qualify for a medical expense that is tax deductible. And Nancy and her family can look at publication 502 at irs.gov to see if his particular care is qualified for the Medicare or medical expense deduction.
And hopefully that will be enough money before the insurance kicks in, because nursing home costs can be so costly on a month-to-month basis. But what if they need to tap those life insurance policies?
Right. And that's another resource, and it's better to use it now rather than to save it later. But they'd like to prefer it, obviously. You can actually borrow money from a paid-up life insurance policy tax-free. If the person dies, sometimes that can, while the loan is outstanding, that can reduce the death benefit for it. But it's a good, easy way to get access to cash if they need it. And then also, some life insurance policies have what's known as a pre-death benefit, meaning if you have a $100,000 life insurance policy, you may be able to get the $100,000 now for expenses, health care costs, nursing home costs, whatever, as long as you're willing to forego the $100,000 death benefit once the insured person dies. That said, if it's possible, I'd like to see them actually preserve the death benefit from the life insurance, because in this situation, when you have a couple where you have one member of the couple who's ailing and another one who may not be in nearly as rough a shape, you'd like to have that life insurance kick in to help replenish all the savings that have been depleted by any medical costs or long-term care expenses.
And what about for those individuals who do run out of savings?
There is assistance available in the form of Medicaid, but sometimes in situations like this, it takes a while to get it processed, and or it may not qualify right away because they have too much in assets. One thing that a lot of people don't think about is many couples in this situation have a home that's either mostly or all paid for, and so they can tap into that home equity via home equity line of credit, maybe getting a new mortgage or even a reverse mortgage. What I'd really like them to do here is see an attorney sooner rather than later, and especially one who specializes in this kind of elder law planning. So to look for an attorney who has that kind of expertise. If you don't know one, go to NELF.org, 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 or ElderLawAnswers.com, ElderLawAnswers.com. And we'll have a link to both of those websites at our website, OnYourMoney.com, later on today.
It is practical advice on life's frequent money-related questions. You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is your trusted guide. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. You can join in with your question, 800-642-1234. Email your personal finance question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. When we come back, hello, graduation day, but then there are the loans. Student debt has just exceeded 1.5 times total credit card debt. That's according to the latest figures from the database of the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. We'll get financial how-tos for adulthood. Stick around for more On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent here with Kevin McKinley, who is your trusted guide in life's money questions. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. What personal finance question has been on your mind? Ask it at 800-642-1234. You can ship it off by email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go back to the phones now with Al waiting in Oak Creek. Hi, Al.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, go ahead.
My question for you guys is specifically, so I've got two short-term goals, and short-term meaning within the next 2 years or so, and it's determining where I should allocate some cash savings. So one of the goals is to purchase an investment property, so a rental property, to gain some passive income and long-term equity, and then the other being a kitchen renovation for our home. So both I plan to pursue both goals, but I've got about $24,000-$25,000 to dedicate towards one of these, and I'm just curious to know which one you think would be a better long-term gain.
Are you in a committed relationship of any kind, Al?
Yes, I'm married.
Okay, I'm assuming it's your wife. And on paper, the smartest thing to do is to put the money into the rental property because that's more likely to generate that kind of buildup of equity that you want. But I'm guessing that a kitchen that either you or your wife doesn't think is up to snuff is probably a smarter thing to do to maintain the sanctity and happiness of your marriage.
That's probably true, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I try to negotiate it down into both ways. Do you have equity built up in your house right now, Al?
Yes.
Okay. Here's what I'd recommend is I'd recommend you keep the cash on hand and put that into the rental property so that it's there when you need it. But if you said, well, we really do, this kitchen really does need to be updated and it's dated and we spend all of our waking hours here, I'd probably talk to the lender first, but say, hey, can I get a home equity line of credit or a home equity loan to do the kitchen remodeling now? And you'll pay a little bit of interest on it, probably in the 4-5% range. But the nice thing about that is that then you have your cash set aside so that you can use that as the down payment for the rental property, because you never know when it's going to come up. And usually in this kind of market, I'll back me up on this if you agree. But if you do find a good property, you have to act really quickly, correct?
Mm. Yeah, that's been my experience, absolutely.
Okay, so talk to the lender and say, ask these questions and say, here are the two things that I'd really like to accomplish. And it's not, you know, you're not out of place to try to do two things at the same time with the same pool of money. But talk to the lender and say, what is my best strategy for being able to do these two things based on my situation? You might even do something like, you know, get a new 30-year mortgage and get a cash out to pay for the kitchen remodeling, and maybe even lower your payment at the same time so that you can increase your monthly cash flow, but also have a better chance of getting a loan for the rental property because your own personal financial situation is in place. Now, it's going to cost you more in interest if you do that, especially if you do it over the longer time, but usually the return that you get from the rental property is hopefully going to exceed the cost of the interest, and the return you get from the happy wife, happy life axiom from getting the kitchen redone, you can't put a price on that.
And Al, those kitchen renos, they can build and build. So easy on the HGTV. Easy, easy on it. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to Charlotte now in Brookfield. Hi, Charlotte.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question. We just got over some financial hardships. We used our credit cards to live off of. And now we're trying to, you know, pay the minimum on the credit cards, but we need to rebuild our savings and our emergency savings. Any advice you can give us?
Yeah, well, good for you, Charlotte. And I'm sorry, how much do you have outstanding on the credit cards right now?
I'm thinking 9,000.
About 9,000? Okay. For some people, they're gasping out there saying, oh my gosh, $9,000 on credit card debt. I'll tell you, folks, that's lower than the average amount of total credit card debt that people have out there who haven't gone through any kind of financial emergency. So, Charlotte, you're actually... you're probably better than average right now, even going through this. So good for you for doing this. What I'd rather have you do is just make the minimum payments now. And then if you have any money left over, set it aside until you get at least 3 months' worth of living expenses covered. So if you're spending $4,000 in a typical month on debt, mortgage payments, groceries, gas, everything like that, you want to have three times that amount, so $12,000 in an account before you then start paying off the principal on the credit cards as well. And Charlotte, do you have a bank or a credit union account you use, right?
I do.
Okay.
I have a credit union.
Yeah. Have you gone and talked to them about the situation?
You know what? We were going to them with... we had someone told us that we could use our paid off cars to pay off the debt, pay off the credit card debt. And we did use one of our cars to pay off one of my credit cards that was coming after me, I should say. So we did pay off that one.
Good.
Now we have, So it's a low interest rate.
Yeah. You're technically jeopardizing the use of the car by doing this. But you did you actually go through bankruptcy or not?
Years ago I did. But this was my husband got cancer and we started using the credit cards to live off of. You know
of course,
I mean?
Absolutely. As well you should. I mean, there's really nothing at all to be embarrassed about in that specific situation, especially of saying, hey, interest rates, debt, everything like that, that was not our biggest concern at that moment, right?
No, yeah.
Exactly. You needed to put food on the table. You needed to make sure, I'm guessing your husband probably couldn't work because of his treatment schedule, his illness, all that. So, no, good for you. That's exactly what you should do. That's what debt is for, actually, to use that money now and hopefully pay it off later. And good for you for trying to figure out a way to do this, Charlotte. You get my total approval of what you're telling me and your situation. So good for you. And I don't be shocked after, 3 to 6 months of making the minimum payments on these cards and building up your credit score. I would go back to the credit union once again and say, hey, can you take a look at this now? And is it possible for us to get a consumer loan that has a lower interest rate or maybe a longer payment term than what these credit cards are charging us so that we can then pay it off even faster? But no, good for you, Charlotte. I'm glad you brought this up because we get a lot of calls and questions here from people say, oh, I have all this money in my 401k or retiring and I don't know what to do with it, et cetera, which are great problems to have. But there are many, many more people out there who are facing these kinds of situations. Some of it is self-induced. Others, the circumstances have thrust it upon you. And good for you, Charlotte, for trying to seek out the best answer and do the right thing. So congratulations to you and your husband.
And Charlotte, thanks so much for telling us your story. Millions of young adults are graduating from college right now, and you have, Kevin, some advice for those first careful financial steps into adulthood.
That's right, Kate. In 2017 to 2018, about a million people are getting their associate's degrees. About 1.9 million are getting their bachelor's degrees. 790,000 are getting their master's degrees. And 180,000 Americans are getting some form of doctorate degree. The percent of the population now who has a four-year college degree is about one-third. That's the highest it's ever been. Of people 25 and older, both in numbers and in percentages, and those degrees do generally translate to higher income. The median salary of 25 to 34-year-old adults who have a college degree right now is about $50,000, and those who have a master's degree is about $60,000. If you just have your high school degree and you're in that same young adult category, 25 to 34, the median earnings is only $30,000, and those with no high school degree, the median earnings is about $25,000. So, and those people who are graduating right now, according to Korn Ferry, are going to make a good living. The average starting salary for college graduates for 2018 is about $50,000. However, 70% of these college graduates have some form of student debt, and the average amount is about $30,000.
So what should their first financial step be?
should be to live as cheaply as they possibly can. You know, we've talked about this before, but I can't say it enough. When young adults leave college, they've generally moved out of a cruddy dorm room or a really ratty apartment or a small apartment that they've shared with two or three other people just to cut down on expenses. And they expect, well, I have a job, I'm an adult now, I should move into my own place, or it should be a nicer place, a place, you know, really, it's more expensive, but I deserve this, I have this really great job. And you would be so much smarter by trying to live as cheaply as possible in that brief transition from your early 20s to your mid-20s. And in fact, there was a recent study that we'll talk about in a second here, but there was a study from the National Association of Realtors that said about 20% of first-time home buyers, when they said, where did you people come from? Did you just move out of an apartment or what did you do? 20% of them actually were living with their parents, and ideally so that they could save money to purchase their house. Don't eat out unless you absolutely have to. Try to eat at work and at home. Don't go out and spend money on drinks. Try to have people over where you can, you know, make hors d'oeuvres, a box of crackers, order a pizza, whatever. Don't add any new credit card debt unless it's an emergency. And finally, try to pick up some extra work through a part-time job if you find yourself struggling financially, and especially if you have some extra time. I spoke with a group of people last week, larger group, and a lot of these people were older and very well off. And one of the things that I said, and I know this to be true from my grown-up job as a financial planner, many people who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, and who just about everybody would consider financially independent, often cases net worths of well over $1 million, and they weren't born with a silver spoon in their mouth. They didn't start out that way. They just worked hard and saved. And I said, many young adults don't realize that how many of us supposedly financially successful people started out broke and started out living in, you know, with many different people, when living in terrible houses, in bad neighborhoods, just because that's all we could afford. We didn't have cars. One couple I talked with, they said, yeah, not only did we live with another couple in a two-bedroom apartment when we were married, the four of us shared a two-bedroom apartment, we also shared a car, too, because that's all we could afford. And so by telling young adults, say, look, it's okay to start out broke, start out in a place where it's not as flashy on Instagram or whatever, but you're saving money that you can use to pay off debt or to save for retirement, you're going to be much better off down the road.
So what to do with that extra money that you're able to put away?
Yeah, as we mentioned with Charlotte on the previous call, set up 3 months' worth of living expenses. That's not only a good idea because it helps you prepare for an emergency like an uncovered car expense or a medical expense, but also if you lose your job, you now have 3 months' worth of living expenses to go find another job. But it's also a good idea because that forces you to figure out what your living expenses are and maybe some ways that you could cut back. You definitely want to use any of that extra money to save for retirement. If you're at work and you have a 401k or 403b where the employer provides a match, save whatever you can to get the match. Then, if you make over $50,000 as a single filer or $100,000 as a married couple filing jointly, stay under the 12% federal income tax bracket, meaning saving enough in your pre-tax plan to reduce your taxable income below that $50,000 or $100,000 level. If you have any money left over, or if it's all the money you have and you think you might need it, save it into a Roth IRA, because with a Roth IRA, you don't get a tax break on the deposit usually, but you can pull the contributions to the Roth IRA back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever at any time for any reason. So that can be kind of your rainy day fund and your retirement savings as well. Set a goal to save at least $5,000 per year, whether that's in a rainy day account or it's in your 401k, whatever, to get at least $5,000 set aside per year. You'll be doing way better than most Americans, and you'll be way ahead of your other peers. And then finally, if you have student loans, only make the minimum payment. Make sure you make the minimum payment, but only make the minimum payment. You're better off saving for the rainy day and saving for retirement than paying down those student loans, especially if the interest rate is only 6 or 7% or less.
Okay, Kevin, here come the big milestones like marriage, buying a house, having kids. You're seeing dollar signs.
It's very expensive. That's right. And I think some of this does come from some of the young adults I've talked to who said, I'm thinking about doing these things. And I've said, well, you know, do you feel like it's the time is right for it? And they sometimes say, yeah. They say, I see all my friends getting married. I see them buying a house, and I want to do it, too. And that's one of the things, again, that social media like Instagram and Snapchat and Face Twitch or whatever it is, they present a false display of people's happiness and accomplishments. And nobody puts on Instagram to say, hey, just to let you know, I'm still living in my apartment. They want to make it look as glamorous and glorious as they possibly can. So there's this social media pressure to feel like you should get started and do all these things that your so-called all of your friends are doing, but they're really not. The 20s are a very unpredictable time anyway. The median job tenure for 25 to 34-year-olds is only about 2.8 years. So about every 30 months on average, you're probably going to change jobs, and that may require to change locations as well. So you probably don't want to rush into something like buying a house. In fact, in terms of getting married, the median age right now is 30 for men and 28 for women for the first-time marriage. And then you also want to rent as long as you can, even though it seems like everyone else is buying a house. The median age for first-time home buyers is 32 years old. So even if you've got to 33 or 34, you're still only in usually about the half of the people who haven't bought their first home yet. And I have three kids. One of the greatest things I ever did, but I did wait a little longer than most people to have those kids. The median age at which people have their first child right now in America is 27 for women and 31 for men. So generally, enjoy your 20s, save your money, and you can have kids and get married and buy a house when you're in your 30s.
Well, let's go back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. Sharon is waiting in Waukesha. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead.
Oh, Kevin, when I retired 18 years ago, I had $100,000 in a PEBSCO account from work, and I went to a financial planner, and he put it in a fixed annuity. It was 5% at that time, and since I didn't know much about money, I just went along with it. Now that $100,000 is now... It was paying 5%, then it went to 3%, and now for the last 2 years, it's at 1%. And my local, and there's no way I can make more or do anything with it unless I pay a penalty. And I guess I'm just, I've been advised now in my later years about fixed annuities, and they're not the best plan.
Well, no, they're usually not the best thing out there. They are relatively conservative, for better or for worse, meaning there were a lot of times during the last 18 years, and if you put it in 18 years ago, that was probably during either right before or right after the big tech crash of 2000, right? Yeah, and so a lot of people like you were rightfully afraid that if they put their money in the stock market or worse yet in tech stocks, they might lose 30 or 40 or 50% of it. And so for the declines of 2000 and 2002 and 2008, you weren't losing any money at that time. So that's the good news about it. What I'm interested in, though, Sharon, is it sounds like you're not in the original annuity you started out in. It sounds like it's been changed into several different fixed annuities during the course of the last 18 years. Is that correct?
Yes, and I talked to my local bank about that, and he just looked it over, and he said, yes, it had been changed, and I guess I agreed to it. I mean, I said, I'm just getting smart now.
Well, and you know, this is the kind of thing you hear a lot of at extremes in market performances. At the highs, everybody wishes they'd been in the stock market. At the lows, everybody wishes they'd been in, you know, put their money under their mattress. And so when you haven't had significant losses in a while, people tend to get kind of sheltered from the pain that you can experience during that time. So don't blame yourself for that. What I'm more concerned about is that these keep rolling over, and every time you roll it over, not only does the salesperson get paid a commission for this usually, but also you start this new surrender charge again, which you would have been out of had you stayed in the original annuity. Sometimes you don't have a choice in that because the insurance company says, hey, no offense, lady, we said we'd pay you 5% for 5 years. It's done. It's your choice to do with that money what you wish. And so you do have to go find another annuity, and you accept the responsibility for that. Again, you shouldn't blame yourself, but it is what it is. How long ago did you take out this new annuity?
I think it was 2014.
Oh, great. Okay, so you've been there for 4 years already, right?
It will be 4 years in October. Right?
Perfect. Okay, I'm glad you're cognizant of that. All right. So first of all, you can pull a chunk of this money out. Usually in most annuities, there's a provision that says you can pull out maybe 10% of the value every year with no surrender charge. So I definitely check into that and see if that's possible. But also with most of these fixed rate annuities, usually the surrender charge expires after 5 to 7 years. Do you know when that surrender charge expires, Sharon?
I don't know.
Yeah, check on that. And then also see, too, if you pay the surrender charge, it usually declines over time. So it might be down as low as 2% or 1%. And then you can decide if it's worth it to move it someplace else and pay the surrender charge or just wait it out. But either way, what I'd recommend you do is probably not move it into another annuity if and when this does come due. And if the financial planner or whatever says, well, that's all I can do for you, then you probably want to talk to somebody else.
Well, Sharon, thanks so much for bringing your story. It's financial insights you can put to use today. You're with us for On Your Money. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can join in with your personal finance question, 800-642-1234. Pack it up in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, what to do about keeping our budget in check as gas prices edge closer to that $3 a gallon mark. Kevin has insights on Shop Around. Don't go anywhere. We'll be back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Practical money tips that you can put to use in your finances. You're with us for another edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and the Personal Finance Brain Trust, Kevin McKinley, is here. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. You can join in the conversation with your financial situation, your money question. Ask away at 800-642-1234. Send it in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Wenzel, who is waiting in Amherst. Hi, Wenzel.
Hi. I'd like to say I really appreciate, one, this option, but two, the thinking that you have, Kevin,
and so I want to run
a couple of options by you. This is a person I'm calling for that lives in a boom area out of state, but you could say it might be like Madison, where the rents are really steep, but you can't get much for even $250,000, and I think he could swing the financing of it, but are some of these areas, you think, in a bubble, or should a person just jump in because you can and try to ride it out?
Right, and this person is probably in his 20s or maybe early 30s, right?
A little older.
Okay. Does he plan, as far as you know, does he plan on staying in the area for the foreseeable future?
Yes. I think, you know, it's a single parent situation, and so, you know, the dependent is kind of with him off and on. So.
Okay. Well, good for him. I don't think it's a good time to, in these bubble areas like you talk about, and there's a lot of them out there, and it's not just New York and Boston and San Francisco, Nashville. Austin, Atlanta, just about any place that's a metropolitan area is drawing a lot of young adults to work there because that's where the jobs are. But then, of course, they put a lot of pressure up on the housing for it. And I'm more interested in two things. One is if this person in question really wants to own a house, because sometimes once the financial prospects of owning a house really aren't as great as they are made out to be. In fact, most of the time, people end up spending more money on things like repairs and updates and everything than they would have, obviously, if they rented. What I'm more interested about it is just the control to know that you're going to stay in this particular place at the same mortgage payment, hopefully every single month. So that part about it, I like about it. And then that's the second part is if this person thinks he's going to live there for the foreseeable future, and then buying can be a good idea. Even if he buys at the peak of a bubble, if he doesn't have to sell, it doesn't matter. because if he's not moving and he still has the job to support himself, he doesn't have to sell. The price of his house could go to zero, and as long as he can make his mortgage payment, he gets to stay there, and eventually it'll come back up again. So I wouldn't worry too much about buying during a bubble from that standpoint, because even when prices do go down, you know, usually as a rule of thumb, it's harder to get a mortgage at that point than it is when things are going well. That's not correct, but it's the way things are. And so he might find that, you know, he might wait until prices burst, and then all of a sudden he might find that the lenders aren't quite as friendly as they are today. So I'd look at more of a personal situation. Does he want to be a homeowner? Does he want the headaches and hassles of owning a home in return for the so-called security of it? And then does he think he's going to stay there indefinitely? Then yeah, I'd have him look at it, but not to make money and not as a financial proposition, and definitely not to say, hey, get in now because it's such a, there's not going to be any houses around there. There's always going to be houses for sale. And what generally is going to happen in these areas, and it's happening already, is they start tearing down old single family houses on a block to build up, you know, multi-use apartments or condominiums, and that all of a sudden creates a huge supply of homes. It's not really not happening fast enough in some of those areas, but there are a lot of other restrictions for it. But that'll increase the availability of units out there and should hopefully kind of prick a little bit of that bubble.
Yeah, big soul searching questions there. Wenzel, thanks so much for asking. My mama told me you better shop around. So just as the summer driving season heats up, kicks off, so have those gas prices jumped up.
It's like clockwork, Kate. Every time Memorial Day approaches, all of a sudden you go, oh, wait a minute. Why? It's normally $54. Why is it $63 this time to fill up the pump? And it's getting up above that $3 range for it. The reasons are the timing of the year, but also higher oil prices. And it really is the strength of the economy as well. A lot of people can afford to drive more, have to drive more to get a better job or to get to a better job. And so they're willing to pay more at the pump for it, and supply and demand definitely has a factor in this. Now, keep in mind, though, when you see $3.50 at the pump and you think, oh, I'm old, I remember when gas was 35 cents. Well, 35 cents a gallon in the 1970s adjusted for inflation is really like about a $2.50 to $2.60 a gallon price right now. And most of us, even though gas really is on the top of our mind for what we have to pay, it's really not a huge part of our expenditures. If you buy about, oh, let's say 520 gallons a year, that's about average, times $3 a gallon, you're spending about $1,600 a year. And if you have two vehicles in a household, even, that's only about 6% of the average household spending. And relative to other liquids, this isn't going to make you feel any better, but it might make you question what you're actually spending on these other liquids. When you buy a 79-cent 16-ounce bottle of water, you're paying $12 a gallon for something that comes out of your tap usually for free. Mm-hmm. If you buy a six-pack of beer, you're paying $14 a gallon. If you buy a $10 bottle of wine, Kate, it's $50 a gallon is what you're paying for, too. And
right,
I've done this myself. You're a parent, too. I've actually, one time, you know, against my better judgment, we rushed into the drugstore to get some children's liquid Tylenol.
Oh, my gosh.
And I grabbed this tiny bottle and brought it up the cash register, and they said, oh, it's $7.99 or whatever. And then after I had some time, I went and sat down and checked the price. I paid $290 a gallon for that children's Tylenol.
So where can we start saving money on gas at the pump?
Start by not shopping around, by driving around. You know, if you have a 15-gallon tank and you drive an extra mile just to get a look around for better prices, you're burning up probably more money than you save. That said, according to Gas Buddy, if you do buy your gas, you don't want to buy it at the most convenient place. Usually try to get it off the main intersections, because the further away it is from the traffic areas, the cheaper the real estate is, and the more likely the cheaper the gas is as well. Gas Buddy also says that if you're going to fill up, you want to do it on Sundays, because not only do you generally get the lowest prices of the week, but there are going to be fewer drivers filling up on that day as well, so you won't have to wait as long to do it. And finally, if you're getting premium fuel for your car and you're paying maybe 40 or 50 cents more per gallon for that fuel, you can probably stop. According to both Consumer Reports and Edmunds.com, most vehicles do not get any benefit from having that premium fuel. And even Edmunds put together entire list of vehicles where premium fuel is recommended, and then another list of where they're required. And most of those are very high-end vehicles like Porsches and Jaguars, etc., not your Hondas and Toyotas that most of us drive. Although that said, a couple of the ones that did recommend premium fuel were Subarus in there. So we're going to post the links to the Edmunds report of which vehicles, and it's not just new ones, it's used ones as well, going back to, I think, 2011, are recommended to get premium fuel, and then ones that are required to. But if your vehicle's not on that, you can probably save yourself 50 cents a gallon by just going with the regular fuel.
So other than driving less, how can we spend less on gas?
Yeah, you want to get your vehicle tuned up, make sure it's running properly, inflate your tires. Definitely, if you have low inflated tires, that not only wears them out faster, but it is less safe to have low inflated tires and then uses more gas. And then also try to gradually accelerate and then decelerate. Gas Buddy says that on average, drivers lose $477 per year when they accelerate quickly from the stoplight and then have to slam on the brakes to once they hit a red light.
Yeah, Kevin, think of an egg under that on that gas pedal and not crushing the egg.
Or better yet, put an egg under the gas pedal.
That'll be a mess. So are higher gas prices a good reason to trade in your current vehicle for a more fuel-efficient model?
Yeah, environmentally, sure. You want to probably burn as little fuel as you possibly can. But for financial reasons, probably not. Let's say you have a vehicle which the average miles per gallon right now on a new vehicle is 25 miles per gallon. Let's say you say, I want to trade up to one that gives me 30 miles per gallon. And if you drive the average amount per year, which is about 13,000 miles, you'll save about 90 gallons of fuel per year. But at $3, that's about $270 per year. Mm. And if just the sales tax alone will far exceed that savings, and especially if you don't keep the car very long, but even the dealer markup will far exceed that $270 as well. And there is a correlation between rising gas prices and demand for more fuel economical vehicles, and so you might end up paying more for it. In fact, if you're a contrarian and you don't care about burning the extra fuel, you just want the best value, it's usually when fuel prices are rising or are high, it's better to actually go after vehicles that don't get great mileage because they're not as in demand, and therefore you're going to get the same vehicle at a lower price.
Well, Kevin, I believe we've arrived at what is the website of the week.
Speaking of your vehicles, there's still a lot of things that go wrong with cars that are subject to recalls. And most of us are subject in one way or another to the airbag recall. And many of us have not fulfilled that. So go to nhtsa.gov/recalls. nhtsa.gov/recalls. And you can punch in the VIN of your vehicle to find out that if it has any recalls outstanding, how to handle them. Usually they're free repairs. And you can also do that if you're shopping around for a vehicle and say, gee, has this one had a lot of problems and recalls? And you can check with the seller if it's a used vehicle to say, have you had all of these things done? And that might be able to give you some leverage in the price. So nhtsa.gov/recalls. We'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And keep your address updated so you can get those recall notices. That's
correct.
Also a good word of advice there. And four more words before we go, Kevin.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, he is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8. It's rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. And this edition of On Your Money was produced by Chris Molina and Keely Baltina. Michael Derringer provided technical support. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and On Your Money, it can be heard on the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening.